Good afternoon and welcome to this lunchtime webinar from Higginson Strategy. I'm Alex Davies, an Associate Director here at Higginson. Everyone on our panel and in our audience will have heard that totemic Michael Gove phrase, "I think people are sick of experts." Well, we disagree, and in fact we polled the public in June after the first peak of the coronavirus pandemic and found that 70% were now more likely to listen to experts. We subsequently launched the Expert Bureau as a platform to allow journalists and policymakers fast access to relevant voices as we go forward. Today, our expert webinar asks, what is the future of UK healthcare? We know that over the past 30 years, NHS hospitals have come under pressure from staff shortages and rising demand, while government funding hasn't kept up with rising costs in the system. Meanwhile, living through COVID has seen the NHS reinforced in the public mind as the UK's foremost public institution. Social norms, working practices, and economic policies have all been redesigned to protect the NHS, which has been at the front line of the battle against the virus. So today, we want to explore how UK healthcare will change and needs to change to meet the challenges it will face in 2021 and beyond, from the rollout of a mass vaccination programme to making progress with the elective care backlog and keeping emergency care safe. To explore those issues and more, we're joined by four experts in the field. Baroness Ilora Finlay is an assiduous crossbench member of the House of Lords, working on everything from the Agriculture Bill, the UK Internal Market Bill, and the Medical Devices Bill. She chairs the National Mental Health Capacity Forum and is a professor of palliative medicine. Mr. Richard Kerr is a consultant neurosurgeon and a council member of the Royal College of Surgeons of England. He chaired an independent commission on the future of surgery in 2018, which mapped out the changes we're likely to see in patient care over the coming decades. Dr. Adrian Boyle is Vice President of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine. He's a consultant emergency physician at Adam Brooks Hospital in Cambridge and an honorary senior visiting research fellow at Cambridge University. Finally, Professor David Peters is a former GP. He's editor-in-chief of the Journal of Holistic Healthcare and a former chair of the British Holistic Medical Association. He also founded the Centre for Resilience at the University of Westminster. Welcome and thank you all very much for taking the time to join us today. So to start us off, can I ask each panellist, starting with Adrian as a practising medic joining us from a hospital, to give us your take on the future of UK healthcare, both in the immediate term and beyond. Adrian.
Thank you. So I was given lots of titles at the beginning, but essentially my job is that I am a jobbing emergency medicine consultant. I'm an ENI consultant who works in a very average hospital seeing undifferentiated patients. And prior to the pandemic, it was very obvious that emergency departments and the urgent and emergency care system is not fit for purpose. Remember, 20 million of us use ENEs each year. And last winter, before the pandemic started, we regularly had delayed ambulance offloads, what we call corridor care, where people were waiting in corridors. This was all due to exit block. And this pressure that we've seen on reducing beds over the years has got now to a crisis point where we cannot admit patients safely. We know that patients who wait a long time in emergency departments to be admitted have adverse outcomes and an increased risk of death. We estimate 3,000 people a year suffer harm as a consequence of long waits in emergency departments. This may be delayed diagnosis, delayed treatment, or even just simple awful things as having a fall off a trolley in a corridor where they're not being looked after. What we saw over March and April and the stage of the pandemic was suddenly these corridors emptied. What has happened now, as workload has gone back into the hospitals and our hospitals have become full and even fuller than they were before, is corridor care has returned. And this is more dangerous because having people cheek by jowl now not only exposes them to risk of picking up flu and norovirus and not being observed properly, it exposes them to the risk of acquiring COVID. There are examples going on throughout the NHS England and throughout the UK where people have caught COVID in an emergency department and spread it around vulnerable patient groups within wards. Our departments are crowded. The cause of this, which is, and you need to understand the cause of why we're crowded, is there aren't enough beds. Now, just this morning, the BBC website reported that since compared to December last year, there are 12,000 less beds in active service. That is 2 to 3 wards for every hospital in NHS England. not only have we lost the actual number of beds, we've also lost the functional capacity of those beds. Because of infection control restrictions, because of the need to ring fence important surgery, it is actually almost impossible to get people into hospital. So our call as a college is that there needs to be urgent effort to increase the capacity of our hospitals to look after our patients. Before the pandemic, we think we were short of about 10,000 beds. We've now lost another 10,000 beds. It may sound delusional to ask for it, but we think the need, if we are to look and run our hospitals at 85% capacity, is that we need an extra 18 to 20,000 beds. That sounds like a lot, but if you consider in terms of the number of hospitals we have, that is probably the equivalent of two extra wards per hospital. And that would have a transformative effect on reducing infection. It is not just about beds. It is also about making sure that people have access to the healthcare that they need. Many people go to emergency departments because it's the only place the lights are on and the only place where they can get adequate access to healthcare. And this is not around personal convenience. There should not be any patient blaming. Royal College is very supportive of efforts by the RCGP to expand the role of general practice. But, and you know, care in the community and pushing care into the community has been an aspiration of every successive administration. But we're going the wrong way. It's hard to get people to be GPs. It's almost impossible to get people to be full-time GPs. But if we're serious about trying to decongest our hospitals, we need to provide people with the access, alternative access to the emergency department. We cannot continue to be the system failure service. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian. Richard.
Thanks, Alex, very much. And thank you for asking me to be a part of this. I'm going to look rather more in the future, accepting that everything wasn't rosy in the health service before the COVID pandemic. I accept the issue about the beds that Adrian's just described. I think the challenges between health and social care were very significant, and that continuing challenge is something that needs to be resolved in the future. I was involved, as you said at the beginning, in writing or looking at the future of healthcare, particularly surgical healthcare in this country. And I think what we were able to emphasize from that document is that we do have the potential in the future to get to a place where we are able to establish diagnosis early on in patients' pathways. We're able to hopefully change the way we deliver surgery to a much more minimally invasive platform, and particularly a platform where we're practicing organ sparing surgery rather than organ removing surgery. And I also think we have the ability to move to much more personalized care. And I think those are things that we should absolutely aspire to, because it's going to result in better outcomes for the patients. Now, the areas that we identified where we're going to see these changes are clearly in the role of minimally invasive surgery. It's in the use of data and particularly the use of genomic data, the use of simulation and virtual reality, and the use of other specialized areas like stem cells and biointegration. Now, I absolutely accept that this is very forward thinking, but I think medicine as a whole is trying to embrace the digital revolution that we're currently in, that we see in every walk of life. And we want to try and see the benefits from that. However, I also think that it will be really important to focus on other measures. And we can't just look towards technology to resolve the problems that we have in terms of the huge wait lists that we're facing. So population health is extraordinarily important, and realizing the benefits of exercise, of weight control, of diet, of getting rid of smoking, and the impact that's going to have in terms of our ability to get patients through treatments, including surgical treatments. So lower complication rates, better outcomes, and particularly a much greater uptake of day case surgery. I think that we need to understand the huge variation in care that is happening across the UK. And there are areas of excellence, and there are areas where, unfortunately, the treatment delivered isn't perhaps quite at that standard. And we need to try to work on resolving that huge variation. Now, the work that Tim Briggs is doing with the GERF program, Get It Right First Time program, I think has highlighted that enormous variation, even in the uptake of Daycare surgery, for example. So going back to the issue that Adrian was talking about in terms of the number of beds, and absolutely we've seen a progressive drop in the number of beds, but what we haven't seen is that progressive uptake in the move towards Daycare surgery that you might expect as a result of that. I think the work of the Centre for Perioperative Care, and this is particularly working with the colleges, has highlighted the importance of looking at the entire patient pathway when it comes to trying to get the very best for our patients. So it's not just that episode in hospital, it's everything from the preventative measures that take place, primary care, into the action between health and social care at the end of it. And then the last thing I want to say is just to emphasize the need for training, teaching and training, team working, and everything that goes with that. And I think that's really important and needs to be focused upon. We're going to deliver healthcare as a team in the future, increasingly so. And we need to be trained as a team. We need to work in teams. And in that way, I think that we will get much better outcomes for our patients. So that isn't to say that there aren't issues and problems. They were there before COVID. But I think there are also things that we do need to look at for the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. David, would you like to go next?
Yes, thanks very much. And thank you for inviting me to be part of this. So let me just say there are two sides to this pandemic coin. And one of the things that the NHS response has shown so clearly is the overwhelming popularity of the NHS and the crucial benefits of having a state-funded service, especially when you compare to the United States response. And although it's been a very difficult time in hospitals, there's been a remarkable resilience of the hospital services in showing their capacity to adapt in emergency. And we've seen amazing altruism in the community, certainly in the first stage of lockdown. I'm glad to see that there's been a huge government willingness to borrow and spend vast amounts of sums when necessary. We've seen increased online consultations, and perhaps that's a harbinger of the future. And we've seen this rapid innovation in vaccine technology. So there are grounds for optimism for more and better pharmaceutical solutions. And Richard mentions systems biology and personalized medicine. I think the idea of P4 medicine, predictive, preventative, personalized, participatory, which I think Leroy Hood coined at the Institute of Systems Biology, demonstrates a framework to detect and prevent disease through extensive biomarker testing, close monitoring, deep statistical analysis, patient health coaching. So these are all positive signs, but this is against a background of very, very steeply declining nursing and doctor morale, frontline burnout, GP overload and early retirement, a shortage of doctors and nurses, probably 36,000 nurses short, according to the Royal College of Nursing, in the hospital sector, and over 100,000 out in social care. We're losing staff due to illness and early retirement. Increasingly, we're seeing industrial and possibly more impersonal medicine being practiced. We've seen a decline in mental health in the population and amongst staff. And overwhelmingly, we've seen the impact of social inequality. And this is not new, and Wanless pointed it out, not least in his reports of 2003 and 4, but the Health Foundation's just noted that the global pandemic and the governmental and social response has really brought health inequalities into sharp focus. And from the early stages of the pandemic, it was clear that some groups are much higher risk of catching and dying the virus than others. We know age, gender, ethnicity, socioeconomic deprivation, all, of course, much worse since austerity bit. All are important, and they react in interact in very complex ways. So we're looking at a scenario where there are grounds for optimism, but my great concern as a holistic critic of the NHS is that we are in danger of dehumanizing our approaches to both to medical education and to delivery. And unless we can address the staff shortage and the problems that doctors and nurses have, which lead them to early retirement and mental unwellness, I think we're looking at a future for medicine which will make the NHS both financially and humanly unsustainable. Something has to change. We are in crisis and the system is broken.
Thank you, David. Laura Finlay, would you like to make your opening contribution and perhaps reflect a little on what people have said?
Yes, thank you. And I think it's been very interesting hearing what people have said. I'd like to take it, if you like, right from outside and then bring it in. So if we just start at the individual and people at home and the individual and the population, we have an epidemic of obesity. And we have to tackle that head on, because it's very clear that people who are obese do less well when they are sick, and COVID has really shown that. But I can tell you, when I started raising obesity right at the beginning of the pandemic as an issue, it hit almost a brick wall of silence, because it was not deemed politically correct, I think, to raise it as an issue at the time. And we also have to tackle the alcohol epidemic that we've got. And we know alcohol fuels domestic abuse. And we know that domestic abuse fuels child dysfunction, which feeds into child and adolescent and then adult psychiatry and into drugs and self-medication with drugs and so on. So if we don't get that public health end right, our supply chain of health disasters will only get greater. It won't lessen. And therefore, we need to have public pressure to accept things like minimum unit pricing. We need to stop alcohol being on sale so easily at supermarket checkouts, which provides temptation for the person who's addicted. They drink at home, they go home, they beat people up. Those people sometimes end up in the ED. A lot of times they're just hidden from sight. Now, in terms of when people are sick at home, we have got to sort out the relationship between health and social care. And with good social care, highly trained, you can keep people at home. If you don't do that, of course, you get out of hours emergency admissions piling up. They all pile into Adrian's ED, as he's explained so clearly. And linked to that, for my own area, which is end-of-life care and people who have long-term chronic conditions, which are getting worse, I feel that we do have to put specialist palliative care, not separate, out in hospices funded by charities which are reliant on fundraising, and some are going to the wall. We have to say, this is mainstream. Everybody should be able to access it. It is a patient's right to access the care that they need, and that actually they shouldn't have anyone behaving as gatekeeper. And we know, for example, there was a paper out this week that some oncologists are reluctant to refer to palliative care because somehow they feel that they're losing control. Here in Cardiff, we've had decades of working completely in parallel. We've got palliative care going down to the ED as well. It works extremely well, and patient care can improve. Adrian is spot on over beds. It is ridiculous that people have thought that if you squeeze beds, somehow you will make community care happen and you will make more day cases happen. Well, you don't. All the evidence is that you don't. And the reason, the fundamental flaw in that thinking, is that community services need highly skilled personnel working in well-managed teams. So you have to have a shift of resources, but you also have to attract, in a way, a different type of person who wants to work out in the community, carrying a lot of responsibility on their own, prepared to take much more balanced risks. And so there has been this risk-averse default of, oh, they better send them in to the ED to be checked out or whatever. And of course, Adrian has explained clearly the disasters of that. And whatever community services and day services, we've got to have 24/7 services. We can't have things closing down. And that means that we need a very different working model. The other area now, if we're right inside the services, is, and again, Adrian won't be surprised at me stressing this, the well-being of staff. We cannot expect staff to provide good care if they are not well looked after. I have the privilege of sitting in on an amazing session that his college ran just last week, and I was so impressed at every presentation there. They really are literally at the forefront, and they are moving things forward. And if we don't look after our staff and value them as a really precious commodity, then we can't expect them to treat other people as a precious commodity. You know, if we look at an extreme of an abuse model, those who have been abused become abusers. How can you expect people to be kind and gentle and compassionate if they are being treated as somehow to be pushed around in a system? And the last thing then that I want to flag up that nobody has is we have huge environmental concerns and wastage. We've got to get to recyclable equipment, recyclable things within the NHS. We've got to decrease disposable wastage, decrease use around single-use plastics. And we've got to find the balance between what was the old-fashioned sterilised kit, you know, that came from theatre in those big green theatre sheets. I remember them well, and being helped into green theatre gowns. And now everything is disposable. But of course, that's got huge environmental impacts too. And if we don't look after that environment, we're not even going to have a world to live in. And some of our expenditure is that we're importing loads of this equipment. Well, we've got to start to recycle and become economically independent on the supply chain. And as we're economically independent on the supply chain, we need to be able to capitalize rapidly on innovations that are happening in particularly in medical devices, such as AI reporting in radiology and so on. We've got to be able to capitalize on that, because that actually can become a good export to the rest of the world and ensure that we are economically viable in order to fund the NHS that we need. So sorry if that's been a bit long, but I try to give a quick overview.
Thank you. No, we've covered a lot of really important territory there. I want to put a question from Isla Tweed to Adrian, who talked about 85% capacity as a target. Is that enough? And how does that compare with other countries and how they were prepared for the coronavirus pandemic?
Okay, so the 85% capacity, it requires just a little bit of understanding how this has worked out within the NHS. So this is a recording of the number of beds available and occupied at midnight. It seems like a perverse to do it. You'd never say how many desks in Whitehall are occupied at midnight. But the system that we use and has been reported for years is that the number of people in beds at midnight, and that neglects a lot of Richard's patients who get very successful day case surgery, a lot of the same day activity that just gets neglected. So 85% sort of people might say, well, you're saying you're having 15 out of every 100 beds empty within your hospital. Actually, that's what you need, because there will be so much flux during the day. How do we compare to other countries? Well, we have the second least number of beds per 1,000 patients in the EU, except Sweden. The difference is Sweden has really good social care. At any one time, probably about 10 to 15% of people in hospital are medically fit for discharge. They may not have had the piece of paper which caused them a delayed transfer of care, which is running at about 5% in the NHS at the moment. But behind that, for every one person who has been formally recognised as a delayed transfer of care, there are probably another two or three people who could be discharged home if the right social care setup was available. And usually it's not about getting people into care homes. It's usually about making sure that they can go to their own home with some additional support, things like a stair ramp, a rail, making sure there's some way to go to the loo without having to go upstairs.
So all of those things would help to free up capacity. Do you think the UK is well placed in international terms in terms of capacity of beds?
No. So I think we are way behind. Now, there are models about how you use your beds. If you look at international comparisons, it becomes very, really complicated because you'll look at it and go, Japan seems to have millions of beds. But actually, a lot of what they call beds are actually residential care facilities, nursing homes, or even just a bit of assisted living. So compared to European countries, we run our hospitals much hotter and we seem to be tolerant of cancelling elective procedures much more than almost anywhere else in Europe.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, look, we've got 5 more minutes. So I want to squeeze in a question from Esme to Professor Peters. You talked, David, about the number of antidepressants being prescribed. Do you have any sense about the prospect for psychedelic medicines to become part of the answer in future? This is now a growth industry. It's nothing has yet, I think, been licensed, but this is beginning to be posited as part of what may be an answer to some problems in the mental health space. Is it something that you've come across, David?
Well, I've come across that. I mean, there's a booming research literature now around the psychedelics, and some spectacular results in recalcitrant depression. But interestingly, I believe even in those almost miraculous cures, there is a relapse after 3 months, and so new ideas are coming forward. But yes, I think that there is potentially a psychiatric revolution here. But I think it's much too early to say. And I wonder if Big Pharma will take an interest in this and it will become commercialized and commodified. And I can't help thinking that will shoot this whole initiative in the foot. But it's obviously a burgeoning area of interest. I know Imperial has a big program, and I think so does UC. And I've heard some spectacular results, but I think the jury's clearly out. But once again, you know, we reach for magical solutions, and I do say we have to be asking, what are the precursors of all these issues, mental health and otherwise? And I go back to what's been said, both by Baroness Finlay and Richard, Adrian. In order to develop trust, we need human relationships, and especially now in primary care, when people are not seeing a doctor they know, and they're again and again going back down that snake, they're being over-investigated and often over-referred. And this is having a huge effect on resource use. We need, I think, to get back to this much more personalized medicine, not just biologically personalized, but human to human. I think everyone's asking for that on this panel.
Thank you, David. I think that's a really good note, perhaps, on which to end, the sense that the future of healthcare is about greater capacity, as Adrian has spelt out. But as all of you have said, it's not capacity just to churn people through the system and bring down waiting lists, but to build proper relationships with people between clinician and patient so that we can really care for them as people and anticipate their care needs, much as Richard's report from the Commission for Future Surgery talks about it as well. I want to thank all of you for taking part and our audience too. You can find out more about Higginson Strategy and our expert bureau at higginsonstrategy.com. And I wish you all a very good afternoon. Thank you.